reloading the cannon today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Last week we had a chat about the canon. We'll continue today with perhaps a little hope of progress. Although I don't know how we'll make progress. We ended kind of at a stalemate, didn't we?
Well, in a quandary, yes.
Because suppose you were teaching a class today, and do departments decide what will be taught in a class?
We used to. I mean, every freshman English class used to be identical to every other one. These are the works you will teach, right? Mm-hmm. And it will include Return of the Native. It will it will be Hamlet. It will be this and that. Mm-hmm. That began to dissolve within probably 10 years of when I came to Augustana. And I think now there isn't any such thing as freshman English anymore. It's more widespread than that. But I think each teacher makes up his or her own syllabus.
Wow.
Based on what they think is important. So there is Augustana from time to time tries to pick a book that every entering freshman should read. And then sometime during the course of the quarter, there are lectures and there are small book discussions about that particular book. And that has had some success and it has had some failures. Chicago does that. Chicago picks a book every year. Mm-hmm. Last year it was The Sixth Extinction. The University of Chicago, which one of the things I loved about being a student there was that when a book came out, the book I remember is Northrop Frye's Anatomy of Criticism, all of my teachers seemed to have read it. And not only my teachers, but teachers in sociology, teachers in physics, teachers in law. And the noon meal, if you went to the cafeteria for lunch and listened to a bunch of teachers, whatever field they were talking about this book. This book got them aroused. They always seemed every year to find a book that sort of entered every kind of discussion from every different angle. And I thought that was so neat. Rock Island has tried that. Rock Island Reads, mm-hmm. or Rock Island Rocks.
St. Ambrose does something like that.
They do that. Yes, they do.
I became aware of that because one year they asked the Genesee School to do a performance of Antigone,
right.
Because that was the
yes.
one thing the whole school was reading,
right.
Students and staff. And I thought that's great, not only to read the book but to see the play.
So there is an attempt to create a shared experience, yeah.
Yeah. But otherwise, I don't know. Let me give you an example. I was trying to put together a canon. Didn't work. But I thought, suppose I were charged with teaching a group something about humanity and maybe about how our country works or something dealing with the problems. I figured there were two parts to that. First, an overview of humanity, and then to talk about contemporary problems or situations. And I thought I'd start with Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari, because he takes humanity from primitive hominids all the way up to the present, and he doesn't skip anything. And he offers some very interesting insights as to the roles that are played by religion and nationality and some of the things we fight about all the time. That would take a fair amount of time to go through that and to have the arguments around it and the discussions. But I think everyone would come out of that with an appreciation of what it is like to be a human and how we got here. To bring us up to date with the world we're living in now, I got three books. The Brothers, by Stephen Kinzer. This deals with two men in the Eisenhower administration, John Foster and Allen, and their mistakes, and the mistakes they sold Eisenhower on, that instead of fighting wars, the CIA could carry out assassinations and overthrowing governments on the QT, which was morally wrong to do. But out of that, we got into the Vietnam quagmire, which we should never have picked up continuing to fight a colonial war. And the second thing was to turn what was potentially our strongest ally in the Middle East, Iran, against us by corrupting their democracy, making it fall apart, installing the Shah so that American and British oil companies could have someone to deal with. Two profound mistakes that you can lay at the feet of the Dulles brothers, although the whole administration was complicit. And yet everybody in the country went along with that. Then I would go to Dark Money by Jane Mayer to explain how the country is working politically today and how it got that way. And another one that helps explain is Blowout by Rachel Maddow, about how oil and gas really are at the source of everything that has been done in this country in modern times. If you read those three books, suddenly you have a clearer view of what our problems are and how we got there.
Who are you talking about as an audience for these books now?
I don't know. I think any rational person would work.
Well, are we... Does that leave out high school students?
No. I have discovered that when I was teaching high school,
right,
I've discovered that adolescents can do anything they're motivated to do. The problem is motivation.
Right.
There's so much energy and so much raw ability. You know, the brain is not fully formed yet in high school, but man, can those kids do things if they are motivated. Generally, we motivate them in the athletics and in the arts. But to motivate them to think, to get involved in issues, to read, that's the big thing. And that is the big and continuing problem. To motivate kids to think, to start thinking, and to read and to learn to look for sources of information that can give them something to work on. So, yeah, I don't know who I'd teach that to, but you give me a group and those are the books I'd recommend.
All nonfiction.
All nonfiction, and that's my weakness, I concede.
Well, my weakness is my list is all fiction and poetry.
Well.
But I can explain why I think that.
Okay, think that. Tell me and I'll think.
Henry James wrote prefaces for each of his novels, and several of those prefaces ended up becoming really interesting pieces of literary criticism. And one that I never forgot and have used a lot in class is his preface called "The Art of Fiction," often published apart from the novel. I don't even remember which of the novels it was part of. And he says, "Here's what's life is like." He says, imagine a courtyard and a building that has almost endless row upon row upon row of windows. The courtyard is life. Behind each window is an individual human being, isolated from every other human being by his own or her own experience, her own thought. And there's no way of going into another room. So here am I sitting down in my little room on the first floor and seeing just a little slice of life. And to me, that's life. This is life. And then suddenly I read Thomas Hardy's Return of the Native. And he's up here at this window. And all of a sudden I'm taken away by how narrow my own vision is of what life is. I thought that's what life was. No, look at this guy. I'm assuming he's telling me the truth. And then I read Conrad, and Conrad isn't like Hardy, but Conrad's looking at his slice of life from a different perspective. And then way up here at this high window is Shakespeare, and I read Shakespeare, and wow. Now, the advantage for Henry James, why everybody ought to read, is that it is the only way we can get into another room and see life in a grander, more glorious, more realistic way than we could ever see it on our own. The mistake students make is they think, as I did, you know, when I was a freshman in college, I'm down at this little window. Who wants to look at this little stupid window? I don't see very much here. And so I'll pretend to be Shakespeare. I'll pretend to be Hardy. I'll pretend to be Melville. Well, that doesn't work because I can't be, right? So first of all, I need to tell my students, look out your own window and tell the truth. See what's there and tell the truth. But at the same time, I need to introduce them to windows through which they will never see unless they experience it. And in fiction and in poetry, they can experience it, not only be told it. In nonfiction, that's very difficult.
That's right.
That's very difficult. And so my list, why I think reading is important is that the more you read, said Henry James, the scales of prejudice fall from your eyes.
And that's, you know, and that's my flaw, too, because I want people to just deal factually, and yet I know that you will listen to a story quicker and more easily than you will someone explaining to you this is how it works.
That's because you will become the story, right?
Yeah, that's right, because you a good story draws you in, and you experience it. And it's the things you experience that really shape you most securely. And it's like my fixation on Phyllis McGinley. If I were teaching poetry, I would start with Phyllis McGinley. She writes light verse. She's one of the best writers of light verse I've ever encountered. She won the Pulitzer Prize. She was given 7 doctorates, a laureate medal from the University of Notre Dame. The problem with Phyllis McGinley is she's not a feminist. She celebrates domesticity. She's perfectly happy being a wife and a mother. And she celebrates those things in her poetry. When she's talking about why she writes light verse, she says, well, there are 2 reasons. One is it pays better than serious poetry. You can always get published and they'll pay you well. Secondly, she says, I think light verse appeals to the intellect and serious verse appeals to the emotions. And that's a division that is hard and maybe impractical to make because we know that intelligence involves the intellect and emotions. And when you get the intellect and the emotions to run in the same channel, wow, that's how Shakespeare works. He can have you think and feel at the same time. And that's why he is the indispensable writer in English. You can't get away from Shakespeare. But I would start with Phyllis McGinley for that very reason, because she is easy. It's an intellectual exercise, but surprisingly, she not only can make you smile, she can make you weep. She can touch you very, very deeply, particularly when she's writing poems that have to do with her daughters and so on. And I would start with that, and then after that, Lord knows where I'd go, because you can all go back to Milton. And, you know, we talk about Milton, what a drag, but what a great poet he was. And then there's Robert Frost, Seamus Heaney, Mary Oliver, T.S. Eliot, Auden. By the way, Auden wrote the preface to her collection, Times 3, which won the Pulitzer Prize. And he said, the false prediction, he said her poetry will last when all the works of the double-domed people have disappeared. But you can't find her books on the market now, which is a shame. But that's because feminists have dismissed her. You know, that business of domesticity belongs to another age and is irrelevant. I think they're dead wrong on that. I think a good life is all-inclusive. It includes the domestic side, the professional side, and everything, and they all should be celebrated. But anyway, I would start with her if I were teaching poetry, and then I would go Whitman, Donne, you name it, and, of course, Shakespeare. But, you know.
Why, of course, Shakespeare?
You cannot avoid Shakespeare. The whole world is in Shakespeare.
Only 13% of English departments at universities in the United States still require Shakespeare for an English major.
I know. They're crazy. They're absolutely crazy.
Why?
Because, as I say, the world is in Shakespeare. Look at King Lear, perhaps his greatest work. There's some argument about which is his greatest work. And I would have said, well, Hamlet, of course. And there are others. But once we did King Lear, the doing of it made me realize that he has taken a domestic problem of the difference between old age and young people. King Lear wants to retire, and he leaves everything to his daughters, but he cuts out one because she didn't flatter him enough. But then he lays an obligation on his daughters that is just too much. He will spend a month with each one. Oh, by the way, I'm bringing 100 knights with me. And that was a way to bankrupt somebody. So the sisters, while they're not very nice people, have a legitimate claim, have a legitimate gripe. And you become aware of that when you see the play. You side with Lear because you feel his deep emotion, but you understand why the girls have done this. But then he doubles that by having another family problem with a son that's legitimate and one that's illegitimate. He brings all these together. And in that towering scene where he and Gloucester, who's been blinded, meet on the cliffs of Dover, allegedly, and Lear speaks more sanity in his madness, and Gloucester sees more clearly than when he had his vision. And it's just overpowering. And the way the play ends just destroys you. And it is an overwhelming work. And then you take the time to read it, and the power of the poetry comes at you in a different way. But the key to Shakespeare is to see it first, and then to read it. Because if you see Merchant of Venice, it's anti-Semitic and so on. You read it as poetry. It's about Christian hypocrisy. The man is a miracle. How could you avoid him?
I've got a little story that might explain Shakespeare for you. As I was thinking about the canon. This is a little folk tale that comes from Northrop Frye, who wrote Anatomy of Criticism in 1957 or 58 or whenever it was. And here's how he distinguishes between great literature and average literature. He says there's an ant living in an ant colony who's a writer. It's a very extensive ant colony, and this writer has been everywhere in that ant colony. And so when he writes something and publishes it, all the other ants say, wow, this is really great stuff, right? And because he's just so knowledgeable about his age and his time. And this ant keeps wandering further and further in the ant colony, exploring further. And one day he sees a hole that he'd never gone up before. And he goes up the hole, and all of a sudden, there's light and flowers and color. And he looks back and he realizes what a little dingy place this ant colony was and how limited his vision has been. And so he writes a new book, and it has color and flowers and light. And the other ants buy his book because he's a bestseller, and they say, what? This guy's gone off his rocker. What is he talking about, right? But once in a while, another ant climbs up that same hole and says, now I see what this guy is taught. This guy is really brilliant. Meanwhile, this ant writer has explored further and further and further this new world of color. And one day he goes out a door and he looks back and he sees that the ant colony is in a greenhouse. And he says, that wasn't the real world at all. That was an artificial world of the greenhouse. And here's the world that's endless with grass and horizons and so forth. And so he writes another book with his newfound knowledge, and all the other ants read it and say, now this guy's really gone off his rocker. This is awful. And then Fry ends the story by saying, what this ant writer won't ever realize, that he won't live long enough to realize that the greenhouse is near third base in Ebbets Field, and that he isn't in the real world yet, right? He's, in other words, Fry is trying to explain why some writers we feel are ahead of their time, and why they will never wear out. Mm-hmm. You know, the bestseller sells his $1 million worth of books today and is forgotten in 10 years.
Yeah.
Shakespeare will never be forgotten. He has so many environments ahead of us.
Yeah.
And I thought that is a really interesting way. And so to me, what I would put in the canon are those works that will always be fresh and new. I mean, every time I read, which isn't too often, Moby Dick, there's something I never thought before because I've gone outside the ant colony and into that world and see something else. I read Huck Finn, and I never read it the same way twice. I read Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, a short poem. I think I've taught that probably 50 times. I never teach that poem without some student raising a question that I'd never even thought about.
I didn't understand you. What poem?
Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening.
Oh, yeah. The Frost poem.
Yeah. I mean, it's a simple poem, and yet it's never it's never going to wear out, right?
No, it isn't.
So what I would like students to read are books that you struggle with, but eventually you'll come to say, this is good stuff.
And the problem is, and the goal of the teacher is, to inspire the student or somehow get the student to go ahead with the struggle. Even though it's a struggle, keep going. And let me help you about this along
right,
the way.
Right.
But this is worth it. And you're right, Shakespeare will never be out of date. And he's all around the world. His plays are performed in every country, even though they're not done in English. But the power of the story and the characters is such that they prevail. And it'll never go out of fashion. And yet, people are afraid of Shakespeare. They think, you know, well, the language is too difficult.
Well, if you're still way back in the ant colony, you're going to have that reaction. What's all this fancy stuff, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But you want to come out of that ant colony because it's a big world out there. And how to lead
It's people, a bigger world than you will or I will ever realize.
That's
or
true.
That any of our students will ever realize.
That's true.
At least we can start the pilgrimage.
But, you know, we've reached a point now in this technological age we're looking back and thinking, wait a minute. Maybe we've made some mistakes. Our technological world is leading to our extinction. Is this exactly what life is supposed to be? In order for us to have these phones and so on, we have to get rare earths and so on. We have to do all this manufacturing, and the end result of that is we're killing the planet. Is that a good idea? So life is not simple. And the complexity of life, we talked about the problems of diversity in society, the complexity in life itself, in the societies that we've created. You know, as a species, man, we take up a lot of space. As a top predator, we feed on everything
right.
in the food chain. So I don't know. What can literature do to help you understand life as you live it, or the life around you, the life that may be, the life that was? How do you do that, Tweet?
At the very least, I think it can enrich. You know, Auden may be right, poetry makes nothing happen. But it does, really. I mean, it saves people.
A line of poetry can stop me cold. If I hit a line that's, I've said before, one line in Shakespeare, there's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And I thought, wait a minute. That's alarming.
Right.
That's an alarming thought.
Right.
And it's right there. It's the line. And sometimes Gerard Manley Hopkins, talking about the earth is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. all this bleared, smeared with toil. I can't recite the line exactly.
But that ends happily, too, that poem.
Yeah, but that, we used a whole class on that one.
Nature is never spent.
Yeah. And nature, thank heavens, nature is resilient, but how many blows can nature take? We are going to find out.
Well, we're finding out.
Yeah, we are. But, boy, I haven't gotten through my list of my canon books, nor have you. We'll have to come back to this after a while and see if we can sort through. And by the way, if you have ideas about the canon.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Send them in.
Yeah, send them in. And let me give you an email address. I'll give you mine and tweets, so you can bother either one of us if you wish. But I'll give you a minute to get a pen so you can write it down. It's not very complicated, though. All you need for me is four magic numbers, 4115. Ahead of it, you put in an unbroken line in small letters, Don Wooten, DonWooten. Then the magic numbers, 4115, and then @gmail.com. Just that simple. So if you want to send me an email with your thoughts on the canon, I'd love to hear it. For Rold, it's RILINES1
at Yahoo.
Yeah, because that's, you know, he is the number one guy. RILINES1 at Yahoo.com. So let us know what you think about the canon, or if you are really cruel, you can let us know what you think of the program. But the canon is going to be a subject, I think, of that we will puzzle about for a long time. And is there a single novel that you can quickly state that everybody should read?
Moby Dick.
Moby Dick. Boy, you get argument on that. But
not by people who've read it.
That's true. But there's so much on the whaling industry that you will learn a lot about whaling. And that may be useful at some point. I don't know. My book is Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien, the greatest effort at a created world that I have ever encountered. I didn't anticipate that when I started. I thought this must be the silliest book that's ever been written. But by the time it was over, I realized I had been in the presence of a masterpiece. So, not that should dislodge Moby Dick, but The Lord of the Rings is a profound work, surprisingly so. And you learn many, many ethical lessons along the way. L. Tweed, I think we've exhausted our time today.
All right.
But we'll give it another shot sometime in the future, but for now, that'll do it. And we want to thank you for your time and attention. We'll be back with a more conventional program next week on Scribble.